Paper 11, Section 3, which is old single column, page 120. All right, let's see here. I guess I don't need any real intro. Remember, we've just started to work our way into the nature of the aisle in the previous section. You know, entitled The Nature of the Eternal Aisle, they introduce you to the fact that there's upper and peripheral and nether paradise. And so we're just going to proceed to go through those one at a time. And we'll see as we get into this first section here on upper paradise. For those of you who are longtime readers, you know this is an exploration in very large numbers. All right.
Section 3, Upper Paradise. On Upper Paradise, there are three grand spheres of activity: the Deity Presence, the Most Holy Sphere, and the Holy Area. The vast region immediately surrounding the presence of the deities is set aside as the Most Holy Sphere and is reserved for the functions of worship, trinitization, and high spiritual attainment. There are no material structures nor purely intellectual creations in this zone. They could not exist there. It is useless for me to undertake to portray to the human mind the divine nature and the beauteous grandeur of the most holy sphere of paradise. This realm is wholly spiritual, and you are almost wholly material. A purely spiritual reality is, to a purely material being, apparently non-existent.
Maybe just go beyond the simplistic of that last sentence. Just as a little subtle sort of subtextual reminder of how unlikely it is that we really know what we mean when we say spiritual. Yeah. I mean, that which is genuinely spiritual, is, you know, they're saying, is basically non-existent in our consciousness, even. You know, it's, you know, again, just all these reminders they're always giving to not take these words that are tied to very high aspects of reality relative to us, as, you know, like they're saying, you know, purely material being, basically. Take those things that are very remote relative to our starting nature and downgrade them to something that you actually can have some immediate understanding of. Because if you do that, you drag the whole structure down with you, you know, and God can't be anything except some limited quasi-material anthropomorphic thing. You know, if you drag all those high facts of spirit, personality, you know, deity, etc., you know, all the way down so that they're something that you can immediately wrap your mind around. You need to keep them remote. Now, did you catch in the middle there? So you have this purely, you know, like I say, holy spiritual domain. So you might guess, okay, so, you know, this is an intense spirit energy domain. It would completely pull apart any individuality likeness. So there's no material structures there, nor intellectual creations. I mean, does that not challenge you? You know, if you're an early reader of the Revelation here, to think of mind as a literal energy, you know, imagining constructing something out of mindful energy and putting it in there and having it, you know, be pulled apart. Okay? So nothing abstract, you know, it's very, very literal, both matter and mind energy. All right, now, one second. Okay, so you have those initial three domains. And maybe one first thing, you notice they use the word sphere again. Remember how we talked about that a little when we started up last time? And they say, well, they just called paradise a sphere. I thought it was more of a pancake. And, you know, remember, in one sense, the word sphere is used, you know, like his sphere of influence, you know, or something like that. You know, we don't literally mean something with a radius, you know, that is surrounding you. Okay. So you use the word sphere in that more conceptual sense. But, you know, you could say, okay, so, but why did they say sphere on the one hand and area on the other hand? So it's a center, you have the actual deity presence. You know, and we've talked about how the Father is completely enshrouded in the Son, and the Son is completely enshrouded in the Spirit. You know, I mean, how else would I visualize this in any way that I can comprehend? You know, if I'm imagining I'm standing on a planar surface and they're at the center, you know, you'd imagine some sort of a hemispherical presence, you know, each one enveloping, you know, the next, you know, the one inside. So, you know, if you have this hemisphere of the presence of the Spirit, and then surrounding that is this sphere, this most holy sphere, you know, sort of this immediate, or domain that's immediately dominated by their presence. You know, so, I mean, that's why they're just purposely, you know, using that as a way to give you a little bit of a sense. It's like, okay, then once you get away a little bit, it's sort of like it, you know, it dies down from being this domain that's really dominated by their presence, their immediate presence, and kind of spreads out into a plane that you just think of as an area. Okay. Now, the other thing there, of course, is notice the choice of terms. I mean, if anyone has any biblical familiarity, you know, and maybe not even needing that, any notion of historical references to the Jewish temple in Jerusalem, you have the most holy place, you know, in the core, the Holy of Holies, you know, and then immediately outside of that, you have the holy place. I mean, that's what they're, you know, so they're using the language of the two chambers in the temple, the most holy place and the holy place, as the analogy. You know, it's like if you want to really know where does God dwell, you know, the idea was God was in the holy, you know, in the Holy of Holies, in the most holy place. Well, yeah, that concept is reasonable, and that there would be a diminishing, you know, contact as you moved away. Yeah, but it's not on the hilltop in Jerusalem. It's on the Isle of Paradise. Yeah, that's where that sense of what must be that humans had so long ago is actually a fact. The most holy sphere and the holy area. Okay, Jason, do you have a little thing you want to bring in?
Yeah, I wanted to understand when it said, nor purely intellectual creations. Most of us on this planet will become finaliters, right? And hopefully we'll be in the presence of Heavenly Father.
But you won't be a purely intellectual creation. You know, you'll be a spirit being.
I mean, if there's no material structures, what if there's spirit structures?
Right. So, I mean, obviously they're saying that
so we can't see them.
That would
with
be
our eyes,
that would right? be totally fun. Well, when you get there, you will be able to. But. But yeah, I mean, see, you know, they're obviously, you know, by excluding material and intellectual structures of any sort, and you know it's not just a void, you know, so there must be some incredibly grand spirit structure to that domain. Spirit is a substance. Pile up spirit bricks and make a building.
absolutum substance?
That's the aisle. See, there's only one material thing that can withstand the immediate presence of the deities, and that's the aisle. Anything else would be, you know, just totally disintegrated by them.
So you can make an abode out of spirit substance. Okay.
It's a literal. It's a literal substance. Okay, and it's you know, it's just a substance. It's not innately divine any more than this, you know, couch arm is innately divine. It's just a substance, okay? You know, and it can certainly, in the wrong hands, be used very negatively, you know? True negativity only comes into play when you're playing with spirit substance. You know, there's a limit to what you can do with material substance. You can't literally... you know, in and of itself, do evil with it. It's not spirit substance. You know, it requires spirit substance for evil. You know, we've talked about that a lot. And think about, you know, just this, you have to keep challenging yourself. All your old notions of what the word spirit mean are all false. I mean, it's just everything that humans have ever thought about that is at best a dim suggestion of the truth, okay, and it certainly has not gone, you know, historically has gone nowhere near just such a simple physics-like thought of spirit substance. Yeah. Spirit is a feeling word in most people's minds. I feel spiritual. No, you stub your toe on spirit. Okay, it's a literal substance. Okay. Yeah. And it's like, well, that seems really remote. Yeah, that's exactly the point. You know, that should strike you as just completely nonsensical. Apparently non-existent. That's the whole point. To come to terms with the fact that there's a substance that's so different than anything you've ever conceived of that, you know, no matter how much you think about it, it's just going to seem like a fairy tale. It couldn't exist. How could there be a substance that I can't, you know, directly feel? It's like, well, if you think about it, you can't feel it in your outer life, but you can feel it in your inner life if you've taken delight in cultivating, having a high enough relationship with reality that you can actually begin to impinge upon spirit and not just call fancy mind activity spirit. Okay, because no matter how fancy the mind structure is, in the presence of genuine spirit, it can't exist. Could not exist there. Okay? Again, this is my whole point. I mean, just think about, you know, everything that humans have, you know, basically everything that humans have ever said and called spirit has just been mind. Okay? It would be completely, you know, vaporized, if you will, by the presence of the Father. It's not literally spiritual. Okay. Yeah. All right. Okay, so I mean, you got those technical things, but it is just kind of interesting that they went ahead and just, you know, used that Jewish temple notion to depict it.
Chris, I was going to ask.
Oh.
Angels and Marantia beings, they have a little bit of that spirit material woven in, right?
And again, those, you know, you can't take an angel and set him in this place, okay? He's not a pure enough fact to withstand. It takes you a long time to evolve to the point where you literally can stand there and not be vaporized by God, okay? It's just literal physics going on here, okay? It's not fairy tales. He is an infinite energy. You have to withstand that, you know, to get even near, you know, to even get close enough where the shielding of the Son and the shielding of the Spirit, and your integrity are enough to withstand being that close. That's why I'm saying, I mean, if you get too close to your adjuster when you're not ready to handle that, it'll just blow every circuit in your brain. It's just, it's an intense energy source. It'll fry you, okay? Just like standing in the here would just fry you, okay? Doesn't matter how much God loves you, okay? He can't change the fact that he's an infinite energy fact. It will just fry you. You have to get to the point where you can stand in his presence. I mean, you know, we want to almost in, from the moment we conceive of God, we want to stand in his presence. You know, but we're clueless as to what that requires. You know, you can just hear him saying, "Do you understand what it's going to take for you to actually be able to stand in his presence?" The infinite blowtorch of infinity. Okay.
You don't want that kind of heat, right?
Okay. It's no heat, but that's some serious light. Okay. Serious light. Okay. Let's read some more.
While there are no physical materializations in the area of the Most Holy, there are abundant souvenirs of your material days in the Holy Land sectors, and still more in the reminiscent historic areas of peripheral paradise.
Just a tiny little paragraph. Okay, they just went ahead and said anything the Holy Land. They just called it the Holy Land. I mean, this is pretty funny how they...
Yeah. You're looking for the visitor center.
Yeah, it's like, you thought about taking a pilgrimage to the Holy Land? Well, you all are. It's just going to take you a while to get there. It's a lot more remote than the other side of the globe.
The holy area, the outlying or residential region, is divided into seven concentric zones. Paradise is sometimes called the Father's house, since it is his eternal residence. And these seven zones are often designated the Father's paradise mansions. The first or inner or first zone is occupied by paradise citizens and the natives of Havona, who may chance to be dwelling on paradise. The next or second zone is the residential area of the natives of the seven super universes of time and space. The second zone is in part subdivided into seven immense divisions, the paradise home of the spirit beings and ascendant creatures who hail from the universes of evolutionary progression. Each of these sectors is exclusively dedicated to the welfare and advancement of the personalities of a single super universe. But these facilities are almost infinitely beyond the requirements of the present seven super universes.
Okay, so let's just back up now and just parse through that so you can get the picture if it wasn't all clear there. Okay, so the first thing they're doing is like the whole notion of in my Father's house are many mansions, and that's why they call them the seven mansion worlds. They're pointing out, well, okay, that's like the first step of how you could understand the meaning of in my Father's house are many, many mansions. The mansions continue after the seven mansion worlds, and on up the mansions go until finally at the center of all things. Now we're talking mansions, okay? Seven grand mansions. So, you go, once you get outside of the most holy sphere, you got this vast elliptical area of the upper surface of the aisle, and and they're saying it's broken up into seven concentric zones. Yeah, that all clear with that picture? The seven concentric regions going around all the way around. Okay, and they tell you the innermost one is for the paradise citizens and the Havona natives, and the second one is for the super universe level. One would think you could just continue. So you've got four outer space levels. Okay, so paradise, Havona, super universe, four outer space levels, that's six. So, you're just left wondering, okay, well, What about that seventh zone all the way around the outside edge? Well, maybe beyond the master universe? You know, there is the cosmos infinite, after all, on beyond the master universe. Maybe. But you can certainly wonder. You know, they're kind of just encouraging you to keep counting, you know, out, and you notice that you're, you know, you're left with a zone that you can't immediately finger as who belongs there. And just like you see the same thing out, you get out to the outside edge of the fourth outer space level, and, you know, what about the rest of that infinite distance? So that's one little thing. Okay, now for the rest of the section here, we're going to really focus in on us, you know, because we always want to know about us. Okay, so you have that second area, that second circuit of area all the way around. Okay, and see, they say that the second zone is in part subdivided into seven immense divisions. So, I mean, I guess the easiest assumption would be you have this big, you know, elliptical racetrack of area all the way around, and some part of that radial, the distance of the strip is dedicated to this, and then some other track of it is for something else. Okay, so some, little ribbon of that great big track all the way around is what we're going to focus on. As being the paradise home of spirit beings and ascended creatures who hail from the universes of evolutionary progression. Okay. So then that ribbon of area, I mean, I guess, again, you just assume it must be just divided like the super universe level is into, you know, you cut the ribbon into seven segments all the way around. Yeah. So then you focus in on one of those segments of that partial strip. Okay? And you think, wow, that must not be very big. Yeah, just try to give you some idea of how big something can be and yet occupy no space as we know it. Remember, the Isle of Paradise has zero volume in the space that we know. So we must all just kind of, how many angels can dance on the head of a penny? We must all just squeeze into a zero volume. No. Okay, there is separation. And the aisle is beyond huge. Okay? As we go into this next section, it should start to really sink in. Okay, just the second circuit out here of area, and just a small portion of that is going to embody what we're about to read. So just think about, you get out there to like the sixth area. Just how unbelievably huge this must be out there. Okay, it's utterly beyond comprehension even. Forget about Googles and Googleplexes. I mean, it's just so, it has to be so beyond enumeration. Okay, so that's what you want to really start to get your hands on here. This is the point of what we're about to read, is to try to get the reader here, and you're reading from the beginning. You're in paper 11, and you think that the Earth is the only inhabited place in the universe, and all God has to think about is you. Okay, try to begin to come to terms with just how many other beings there are. And how big the infinite God is, that he can love every one of those beings as if they're the only being in the universe. Yeah. All right, so let's see. And I think, why don't you just read the whole thing? And our eyes will glaze over about a third of the way through. And then we'll go back and we'll slowly parse it.
Each of the seven sectors of paradise is subdivided into residential units. suitable for the lodgment headquarters of 1 billion glorified individual working groups. 1,000 of these group units constitute a division. 100,000 divisions equal one congregation. 10 million congregations constitute an assembly. 1 billion assemblies make one grand unit. And this ascending series continues through the second grand unit, the third, and so on, to the seventh grand unit. And seven of the grand units make up the master units. And seven of the master units constitute a superior unit. And thus, by sevens, the ascending series expands through the superior, super-superior, celestial, super-celestial, to the supreme units. But even this does not utilize all the space available. This staggering number of residential designations on paradise, a number beyond your concept, occupies considerably less than 1% of the assigned area of the Holy Land. There is still plenty of room for those who are on their way inward, even for those who shall not start the paradise climb until the times of the eternal future.
Okay. All right. So, see, so it's just each of the seven sectors. So you're taking one, you know, one of these sectors, you know, tied to one of the super universes, and then we're going to unpack it. Okay, so they're subdivided into residential units suitable for the lodgment headquarters of 1 billion glorified individual working groups. Okay, and a finaliter working group, you know, one of these individual working groups. A finaliter working group is 1,000 individuals. So one of these lodges, one of these dwellings, a billion of those working groups, so it holds a trillion individuals. One of these lodgments holds a trillion individuals. So that's the little, you know, atom that we're going to build things with here. That's the little nugget of size. Starts with a trillion individuals. Trillion is one with 12 zeros. You know, a billion is one with 9 zeros times 1,000. See. Trillion. Okay. Okay, so, all right, so that's the fundamental unit, see, like they're saying. Okay, so then notice the pattern as well as the numbers as we're building out. Okay, so you take one of those units with a trillion individuals, and there's 1,000 of these units constitutes a division. Okay, so why 1,000? Okay, we're working out in the pattern here. There's one unit for each minor sector of that super universe. 1,000 minor sectors. Okay, and you might say, well, what about major sectors? Well, remember, when you're ascending, you just go through one local system, one constellation, one local universe, one minor sector, but you go through all 10 major sectors. See, that's not, you're not an individuality there. You're actually scoping out the whole super universe. Okay, on that level upland, Splandon, the level upland. Okay, okay. So the first, you know, literal individuality unit in the super universe is the minor sector. Okay, so. One unit of a trillion for each of the 1,000 minor sectors. Okay, and then 100,000 divisions equal one congregation. So there's one of these divisions, you know, 1,000 units, one of these divisions for what? What's the next notch out? What is there 100,000 of in a super universe? Local universe. So there's one division for each of the 100,000 super universes. Okay? And then 10 million congregations constitute an assembly. Okay, so there's one congregation for each of the 10 million constellations. Okay, and then finally, 1 billion assemblies make one grand unit. There's one assembly for each local system. Okay, so that builds up from the unit to the grand unit. See, when you flesh through the numbers of the super universe, individuality. Well, what kind of a number have we built up to now? Okay, you started with that fundamental unit has 1 trillion individuals. If you just multiply all these powers of 10 together until you have 1 billion assemblies make one grand unit, one grand unit is 1 undecillion individuals. 10 with 36 zeros after it. You know, one with 36 zeros after it. Yeah. 10 to the 36th. 10 to the 36th. Yeah, and, you know, that's probably, I mean, if you're a boy, a lot of boys will get into that when they're little, you know, they'll discover that there's these names, you know, million, billion, trillion, and they're like, well, it comes after that, you know, and they'll figure it out. You know, it goes million, billion, trillion, quadrillion, quintillion, sextillion, septillion, octillion, nonillion, decillion, and then you can keep going, undecillion, duodecillion, etc. Okay, well, let's just stop for a second. If you've never thought about that, why are numbers called that? I mean, you have the basic, you know, like when you're doing Roman numerals, you know, you have an M for 1,000. And that's the biggest, you know, you have C's for 100 and then the M for 1,000. Okay, and that's it. Okay, so that's that kind of that biggest number is 1,000, the M. Okay, so then their next thought was, well, what about 1,000 of those thousands? Okay, you know, the Latin for 1,000, milla, I mean, okay, so that's million, C is 1,000 of those thousands. Okay, billion, you know, by. Okay, so it's 1,000,000 of those thousands. And so million, see, billion, two. So yeah, if you have two, so you have one power, you know, three and another power of three, six, but it's six of 1,000. So there's nine. It's 10 to the 9. See, 1 billion is 10 to the 9. Okay, trillion, you got 1,000,000,000,000 of those thousands. Quadrillion, 1,000,000,000,000,000 of those thousands. So that's why they're called, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 like that, up to decillion. Okay, it's just how many thousands you multiply by that original unit of 1,000. Okay, so when you're up to a decillion, you have 10 threes, that's 30 times the original 3,000. See, that's 10 to the 33. And then the next one, undecillion, you know, the 11. That's what comes after 10 is 11. Okay? So it's 10 to the 36th. 10 to the 36th. One with 36 zeros after it. Okay. Try to wrap your mind around how many individuals that is. Okay. For instance, okay, you know, we're just talking one super universe here. For one super universe. Okay, so out in that super universe, when it's totally complete, there's 1 trillion inhabited worlds. Okay, well, if you have, just in a grand unit, you know, it goes on beyond that yet. Okay, but just in a grand unit, okay, 1 trillion is 10 to the 12. Yes, it's 10 to the 36. So that's 3 12s, okay? So in other words, each one of those trillion inhabited worlds in that super universe could spit out 1 trillion trillion finaliters. Okay, or another way of looking at it, each of those trillion worlds, you take one of them, and every year, imagine it spits out 1 billion finaliters. It could spit out 1 billion finaliters a year, you know, produce, we don't have to be so creative about it, it could produce 1 billion finaliters a year for every year, you know, every year, for 1,000 trillion years. Okay? 1,000 trillion years, 1 billion finales a year. Okay, that's the kind of residential space we have here. Okay? All right, and that's just the ground unit. Okay, then notice after that. So after you build it up to the full, hierarchy of numbers of a super universe to synchronize with that super universe. Okay, then it goes into sevens. Yeah, each super universe, for each super universe, you have 7 of these ground units. Is the first thing. And you can say, well, why is there 7? Well, remember, each super universe is overlaid by a 7-fold womb of the 7 reflective mother spirits. Every super universe kind of automatically has this 7-ifying, totality to it. Okay. So you take 7 of those grand units, and that makes a master unit. And then you take 7 of those master units, and it makes a superior unit. And 7 of the superior units makes a super superior, and 7 super superiors make a celestial, and 7 celestials make a super celestial, and 7 super celestials finally make a supreme unit. Okay, well, that's 6-fold sevens. Okay, 7 to the 6th power. Okay, so that's over 100,000 again. Okay, so we started with 10 to the 36. Multiply that by something bigger than 100,000. Okay, we've got more than 10 to the 41 now. Okay. For one super universe. 10 to the 41. One with 41 zeros after it. Plus a little more. This is just the individuals from the super universe that need a residence on paradise. This doesn't count all the people that just live out in the super universes and stuff. Okay? I mean, the numbers we're talking about, okay? You're one in this, in the super universe of Orbentine, you're one of over 10 to the 41 finalers that's going to end up there. That's what absolute love is like. He can pick you out of a pile of 10 to the 41 beings, plus countless others, okay, and love just you. You don't get lost in that. Okay? How much bigger is that God? Just wrap your mind around 10 to the 41. How much bigger is that God than the anthropomorphic bearded guy in the burning bush? Okay. Okay. This is what, I mean, infinity has consequences. That's what they're trying to get at here. Trying to get you to really let go of some simple notion of God, or his mansions. Okay. An infinite God, it's got really big mansions. Okay. Really big mansions. Completely, like they're saying, it's just beyond your concept. I mean, I can say 10 to the 41. Yeah, what the hell does that mean exactly? Even to say a trillion, where we started, is,
it's fading.
Right. Yeah.
The book's trying to get us to not worry about it. Is there going to be space for us?
Yeah. There definitely will be space. And after you go through all the way up to supreme units, they say, but even this does not utilize all the space available. It's just on and on and on it goes. And we're just talking about part of the second circuit of area.
Right. Well, again, the only way you can really express it is to recognize the magnitude of God in comparison with what we have been programmed to imagine as God.
Right. So even though you're going to spend, ages maturing to be able to stand on paradise and worship in the presence of the Father and all this, you're going to be a lot faster, a fact than you are right now. But still, imagine what it's going to be like to stand on the aisle. I mean, you go, wow, this is all there is to it? Your ability to consciousize that much stuff, you won't even be close to it. I mean, it'll seem like it's infinite. It will seem like it goes on an infinite distance. Unfortunately, you don't have to actually walk to get from point A to point B on paradise. You move volitionally. If you didn't move volitionally, you'd never get anywhere. It's like an infinite distance between any two points. Okay? It's just so insanely huge. Okay?
Need that volitional bus
pass. Right. Okay. All right. So occupies considerably less than 1%.
Considerably less
than 1%. Okay. So it's just, just think about, the first time you heard about the Isle of Paradise in your ancient book and you try to picture this little pancake, little stick figures running around it. And remember, this is just the grossest of shadowy projections of the fact of paradise. I mean, it's like they're saying, this is not simple area like we think of area either. It has dimensionality that we can't even comprehend. So, right, it's just even this shadow projection of paradise is beyond our comprehension. I think you get the point. This is why, you go, well, I mean, the cosmos infinite, wouldn't that require like an infinite aisle to be the, okay. All right.
You talk about volitional movement, so we're not going to be walking.
No, you choose to move through the.
I choose to go be with the Father and worship the Father. I would just worship.
Yeah, you're there in that. All right, but obviously, initially, remember, this takes a lot of work. The first time they take you there, you're trying to figure this out. This is what Gene was asking me before class. You have to remember the space there is existential space. It's the separations there are not so much what we would kind of call quantity-like separations, where you measure with a ruler. They're quality separations. And so you're choosing to navigate in this, I don't know what else to say, but quality space, see? And initially you have a very dim view in that space, and you're groping around in the dark, and it's like, well, now where's the infinite spirit? and you're randomly, choosing, see how many random choices in an infinite space, it'll take me forever, but the more adept you get at, the more you can will your way where you need to be from point A to point B.
Our body is transported just from our will.
You just right. I mean, as it should be. Yeah. I mean, that should just sound nonsensical. Again, apparently non-existent. Right. Only not. But that's a. In a way that obviously I could only butcher to attempt to explain. you move in this domain.
Well, Chris, don't we have guides?
Sure. Yeah. But you have to find the infinite spirit, and you have to find the eternal Son, and you have to find the universal Father. And if you fail, then back to the super universe.
What are these guides doing then? They're showing us how to worship.
Well, no, you go up and read that part. I mean, you know, they're helping you with the basics, you know, but you have to find that personal connection, because it's just that. Only you can find your personal connection. They can't guide you in that. You have absolutely unique personality. There's a connection to the Son, the Spirit, the Son, and the Father that only you can find, and they can sort of help you to, you know, with some of the, you know, I mean, you need to know a little bit about the formalities of paradise, you know, and not to say the wrong thing to the wrong being, or, you know, paradise etiquette, and, you know. Right. But it's your quest.
To get to the Father, we have to actually have the will to get there, and then we get there by ourselves.
Well, I mean, you're transported to the paradise and everything, you know, but, you know, once you're on the aisle, you know, and think about that. I mean, it seems like it's a simple thing. You know, they talk about the deity presence. It's all just in the center. Well, can't I just walk towards the center? It must not be that easy, because even if you've found the infinite spirit and you've found the eternal Son, beings from some super universes who don't have a natural resonance with the Father could fail to find the Father. Okay, it's like, well, can't you just go... See, I mean, so again, see, obviously our simple geometric picture here is wholly inadequate. Okay, this must be just the crudest of distortions of it. Because if it was simply just a matter of, you know, finding the arrow that pointed to the center of the aisle and walking along it, okay, no one would fail to find it, okay? Okay. Right. So, I mean, you just, the more you think about this, the more you realize that everything they tell you about the aisle is crudest of crude distortions of what the actual experience and difficulty in play is. Okay. All right. So that's it. We're done with that. You know, we've mapped out every square inch of the upper surface now. Okay. So just
distracted by the upper surface.
They give you that little bit. They say, okay, moving right along to peripheral paradise. It's like, okay, I can't think of anything else to say. Notice that when all is said and done, all he really did is just try to get you to recognize the numbers involved, okay? I mean, the notion we have of God, you know, is so limited. Okay.
Because, you know, the thought has crossed my mind. Is there space for all of us? You know, I have thought that, but now I definitely clarifies.
Yeah. Here. Be like living in New York City.
Yeah. Right. I mean, literally, you know, everyone on this planet, you know, right now can fit in the closet of that residence, okay? Okay. I mean, it's just, okay. A few billion is just nothing, okay? Totally in the noise. Okay.
You know, it's really hard for me to imagine us as a spirit being what it's going to be like.
Right. And that's what you, and you should just let yourself be with that. That's what you want. You want to know that you don't know and delight in that fact and can't wait to journey the distance it's going to take to actually understand that. You know, that's the excitement. I mean,
just be romantic.
Yeah. That you're journeying towards things that you can't even remotely comprehend. How cool is that? Yeah. All right, let's do a little peripheral paradise here.
For peripheral paradise. The central aisle ends abruptly at the periphery, but its size is so enormous that this terminal angle is relatively indiscernible within any circumscribed area. The peripheral surface of paradise is occupied, in part, by the landing and dispatching fields for various groups of spirit personalities. Since the non-pervaded space zones nearly impinge upon the periphery, all personality transports destined to paradise land in these regions. Neither upper nor nether paradise is approachable by transport supernifum or other types of space travelers.
Traversers.
Traversers.
Yeah. I mean, it's literally meaning I have to have beings that can traverse space. Okay, yeah, right. So in our initial picture, we've got this big elliptical disc, you know, pancake-like thing, right? And the periphery is that rim, okay? Okay, so they start out and they're saying, okay, if you zoom way away in a remote picture, okay, it would, on the scale where you can, you know, sort of wrap your vision around the whole aisle, and you look to that edge, it would look like a perfect right angle, you know, an absolutely razor sharp right angle, okay, at the edge of the plane to the straight side to the straight bottom, okay. So, okay, it ends abruptly, okay, it's a sheer right angle change, okay. But if you zoom in and you think I'm going to try to balance on that. Okay, you're there, and it's like, no, I'm not. I couldn't be. You know, if you're standing right on that razor sharp right angle edge, it would look like you're standing on a plane as far as the eye could see in every direction. Okay, that's how big the aisle is. Okay, so if you take that, the sharpest angle is like you're standing on a plane, basically. Is it really that bizarre to call it a sphere? Okay? If you're standing on a walking, it's going to seem like you're walking on a sphere, okay? Just like on the Earth, you know, it looks like we're on flat ground no matter where we are, you know. It's only when you get a really far view, you know, and you send a ship off with tall sails, you know, that you can see it start to, you know, you actually start to see the curvature of the Earth, okay? But this is so much bigger than that, okay? You're not going to see the ship, you know, if you're standing on that right angle edge and imagine a clipper ship sailing off, you know, you won't see it dipping below the horizon. It'll go out of sight before it seems to lower any, okay? It's just gigantically huge, okay? All right. So there's that again, just to try to get you to not diminish how big a place it takes for an infinite being to stand on. Okay. Three infinite beings stand on this thing. It's got to be really big. Okay? Okay? Now here we get into, where you begin to recognize how crude any geometric picture of this is, how corrupted any attempt to express it in some simple three-dimensional, you know, consciousizable geometry is. Okay, anyone who's read the book for a long time, you know, remembers like the reference about the Maltese cross and, you know, and this sort of stuff. Okay, this basic notion that you got this elliptical disc down in the center is the aisle, and we imagine that above that disc, there's this big cone, you know, flaring out cone of space that we call the non-pervaded space above upper paradise. And then down, there's another big cone pointing down the other domain of unpervaded space. And then there's this big flaring disc of space, you know, pervaded space, goes all the way around, you know, extending out from the periphery and flaring out thicker and thicker as you go farther and farther away. You know, so it's this big disc that gets thicker as you move out, and it's got a hole cut out in the center. Okay, so that you have these two, three. In that picture, you've got these three domains, these two big cones and then this big disc with a hole cut out in the center. You know, and down in that center, in between the two ends of the cones and in the hole, you know, is the aisle, and all the space between the cones and the big disc, you know, completely around the aisle, actually touching the aisle, is not pervaded or non-pervaded space. It's mid-space. So that's one of the pictures that they give you to try to visualize the relationship of space to the aisle. The importance of that picture, immediate importance, what we're talking about here, is that it's a simple way of geometrically presenting, without too much distortion, a picture where no pervaded or non-pervaded space actually touch the aisle. You know, only mid-space touches the aisle. That's one of the advantages of that depiction. Okay, if you try to take that picture into this paragraph, it doesn't make any sense. Okay, because that depiction is of no use for what they're trying to convey here. So they give you a different picture. Okay, so in this one, so you notice, since the non-pervaded space zones nearly impinge upon the periphery, and you're trying to think, wait a minute, I thought the non-pervaded ones are up here and down here. You know, they're like as far away from the periphery as you could get. Is that a typo? Do they mean the pervaded? It's like, no, because it's just, again, it's not literally like that. That's just an analogy to give you some parts of the relationships. For this one, there's another analogy we'll read about. I think it's in like in a couple couple sections here. In the other way to think about the relationship of non-pervaded and pervaded space to the aisle, they say, think of an hourglass. We love our hourglass analogies. So we can use an hourglass analogy here again. So imagine we have this big hourglass, and that entire hourglass is the non-pervaded space. You know, inside the hourglass is the non-pervaded space. Okay? And right in the neck of the hourglass is a spherical bubble. That's a bubble of mid-space. And the aisle is in the center of the bubble. The bubble's in the middle of the neck of the hourglass. Okay, see, in that picture, obviously, you know, as you're coming down, you know, in the neck, that peripheral, you know, right there at, you know, next to the periphery of paradise, this non-pervaded space is getting really close. In this picture, pervaded space is not right there by the periphery. Non-pervaded space is. It's like, well, where does the pervaded space fit into this analogy? Okay, so again, if you have this big flaring disk of pervaded space all the way around the equator here, the picture, all the way around the neck of the hourglass, okay, in the first picture we had a hole in the center of that disk. Okay, get rid of the hole, fill in the hole. And so now extend the disk in, but okay, if my hand here is the bottom of nether paradise, the bottom of my hand is the bottom of nether paradise. Okay, so here's pervaded space coming in, and it becomes this sort of, you know, thin disk, and imagine it dropping down below nether paradise in this picture, and cutting through the neck of the hourglass, so that in that little disk of pervaded space, there's a confluence of pervaded and non-pervaded space. They're both there. In that little cross section, as that disk cuts through the hourglass, both types of space are there. The non-pervaded and the pervaded are there in that little disk of a cross section through the neck of the hourglass, just below nether paradise. So the whole journey, these space traversers, the journey to paradise is a journey of steps. And we know our journey literally, you know, is going up the staircase of the sevenfold. You know, and the Havona, the circuits of Havona are like steps of that staircase. You know, and it's just ever, ever higher steps. The closer to paradise you get, there's more steps to climb. Step by step, you're letting go of what you have, you know, and moving towards paradise. you know, which is nothing that you have. You know, you're step by step, you're eliminating everything that you have relationship to until you're in that absolute domain of paradise. So the way these space traversers do that, they're in pervaded space. So you can picture them in this picture. Okay, so here again is the bottom of paradise. They're journeying in, you know, through Havona and stuff here. They've got all this space they can travel in, this pervaded space. They come into this real thin part of the disk, okay, and they get you know, underneath the aisle. And now they're in, you know, both pervaded and non-pervaded space once they cut into the cross-section of the hourglass there. So they can transition from pervaded to non-pervaded space. That's another step. You got to let go of pervaded space.
Can you please explain pervaded and non-pervaded again?
It just means, pervaded means there's energies and forces and presences there, and unpervaded means there's nothing. There's no force, there's no energy, there's not even any presence of the unqualified, you know, there's no space potency as we would understand it or anything. It's just space, empty space as we would understand it. Okay? Yeah. So you're coming in, you know, you're totally unpervaded, then you're in both, and you go up and go out of the both area into just the non-pervaded part. Okay, so you've let go of pervaded space. And then you go, you know, now you're as close to the periphery as you can get. Now you have to let go of non-pervaded space, going to mid-space. And then you have to let go of mid-space and go onto the periphery of the aisle. Those are those last steps. And so you have to have a transport that can go through those transitions. Some lowly transport is not going to be able to go out of pervaded space into non-pervaded space and then into mid-space. Yeah. Okay. So you have to have a transport that can literally take those last steps for you. Okay, make those transitions. Okay. So that's, yeah. Okay, see, so that's, it's that, you know, and it's like, well, that doesn't jive at all with other people. That's the whole point. I mean, none of these analogies is to be taken as a literal geometric picture. There is no such thing. We're talking transfinite dimensions and stuff. Okay. And we're just using finite analogies to try to understand the relationships in some logical way. Like we just did. We put the pieces together, you know, so that space is close to the nether paradise rather than the upper surface, and we make this transition, see all this stuff, and we get it, we land on the periphery, on peripheral paradise.
What you do is model it in 3D.
Okay. Okay, so that's the picture they're painting there. You need to work through all that because that, I mean, if you're a long-time reader, if you really listen to what you read there, it's like, wait a minute, that doesn't make any sense to me. Since the non-pervaded space zones nearly impinge upon the periphery, what? Okay. It's just not what you're expecting with the Maltese cross picture, okay? Okay, because that picture breaks down.
So we can go, we'll go to the periphery, but that's it. That's where we land.
Right, so you land on the periphery, and then you start this moving about, and yeah. And so, see, it's going to be a journey. You know, again, your whole journey towards the center of the aisle is going to be a whole series of steps. You know, I mean, every step you take along the periphery towards the upper surface is going to be moving away from your anchor points. You know, cutting more and more tethers. You know, you got to cut them all in order to get to the center.
Wow.
Okay, you have to be able to stand absolutely independently. Look, Mom, no net, okay?
No.
Not even a rope, okay? Okay? You have to stand on your own.
So is Mother not there then?
The aisle is there.
So that would take
you're standing on the aisle, but
you're not used to that.
But, man. Yeah, it's just, right. I mean, you're not going to fall, But it's just, you know, you have to somehow be able to, you know, to do it on your own. You know, that's what I mean by stand on your own. You have to be able to do it on your own.
And for some folks, of how many countless numbers, will actually have companions. So right. Why does it sound contradictive to what
right. you see,
just said?
Right. So you always have companions, but you always have an absolutely unique personality. No other personality, no matter how many times they've stood in the very presence of the Father, no matter how many times they've navigated this on their own, they can't navigate the path that you have to navigate. There's an absolutely unique path that can only be navigated by you. That should also help you to, wow, so that, I mean, we're not talking about anything about what I thought personality was. It's not some sort of a vague, no, it's this absolutely unique thing that literally means that only you can navigate like that on the aisle. You know, this volitional navigation. Okay. But it's just, unless you figured out how to do this, you also can't find anything. You won't hit anything, but you can't find anything either. You know, you're going from, if I put you there right now, you have absolutely no experiences. You don't feel the aisle under your feet. You don't see any light. You don't see any. There's zero experiences for what you are right now.
I'm lost here.
Right. Right. So you go from what you are right now, which has zero ability to navigate there because you have zero ability to see anything or feel anything or anything, to someone who can actually, on their own, make an absolute navigation to that one face of the Father that is only for you.
So, if we land on the periphery,
mm-hmm.
and our residence is in the... yeah. Well, do we...
Well, at least one, two. Yeah.
We don't really have any relationship to those outer... levels, would we?
Yes, I mean, you're just left to wonder about what, you know, what, okay. You know, what is all this other stuff about? I mean,
we must just move immediately to.
I mean, I don't know. I don't know what to think.
It doesn't say.
Yeah, right. You just, I don't know. I mean, it's yeah. You as an experiential phenomenon. But what about your adjuster? Which, of course, is you at that point. You know, it's not your adjuster. It's you.
More than the one edge.
But he would know the way because he's part of God.
And pretty personal.
But he'd be personal with us.
Yeah, but, you know, I mean, it has never made that journey either because it, you know, you see.
Yeah, he's relying on you as a person.
I mean,
well,
and, of course, remember, I mean, at this point, you know, there isn't an it in you. I mean, you're one and the same thing. It knows how to get to the Vennington. It doesn't know how to get to the center of the aisle.
And you can't land on Divinington.
So it probably won't help you much on the aisle. See?
We should make it sound like we're going to be kind of left.
Yes. That, and the extent to which that's scary is the extent to which you got growth. See, I mean, it is. You got to recognize there's absolutely no one that can help you. Not even the eternal Son and the infinite Spirit can help you find the Father. Your personality is absolutely different from theirs. They know nothing about your personality. They can't know anything about it. You're absolutely unique. It's all you.
And we're going to have the tools we need. So
right.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, you've been, right. Like, doing this for billions of years. But that's just the whole point. You know, it's not. You know, you're not afraid, but it's like, wow. I seriously don't have. Well, that's what we're picturing. You know, if you try to do it ahead of the time when you're ready, you know. Right, yeah, it would be dumping you there with no hope. Even, I mean, we're not from a problematic super universe because we have all three, Father, Son, and Spirit, influence in our super universe. But, you know, if you're one from one of the other super universes that doesn't have one of the three, there can be issues with the Father, the Son, or the Spirit for you in finding them personally. So even with all of that, working up to it and all the tools, and all the helpers and all this, you still fail. Because you just don't quite have the ability yet to say, get distinguish the Father out of the glare of the Son. You just can't find him personally. He's lost in the personal glare of the Son, for instance.
Yeah.
Father face, you know, your unique face, facet, mm-hmm. that would talk you in and be your homing beacon.
Yeah.
And as long as you focus on that, he would pull you in. So you're not flailing about.
Right. See, and so that's the whole point. Those that don't succeed can't quite get themselves absolutely focused down on their personality so that the link can be made. They can't quite bring it to a solid focus yet. They're missing something in their toolbox still. They need to get some more experience yet that allows them to get that last little measure. Because if you can bring it to a solid focus, you'll find the infinite spirit and the eternal Son and the Father. But if you can't quite bring it to a sharp focus, you won't.
I'm interpreting that you're saying you can fail going to paradise.
I mean, we won't. But beings from other super universes can. You know, like let's say you're from the first super universe and all you have is Father influence. You know, there might be issues with, you know, finding the infinite spirit or the eternal Son. Or let's say you're from the second, you only have the Son. There might be issues finding the Spirit or the Father. Okay,
you opened up another can of worms, though. But what I was asking was, how many tries do you have? An infinite amount of tries
to come back? No, you'll only fail once. I mean, you never fail a second time.
Okay.
You go back, you get that little bit you need, and then you succeed. And again, it's not an issue for beings from the seventh super universe. It's from beings from other super universes. Yeah. Okay. All right, so that's kind of the biggie there, the big kind of non sequitur, is that geometric thing. Oh, wait, what?
I have to, because it doesn't, you're saying fail. I don't get that at that point. It seems to me like,
No. What part is...
You literally cannot, these beings, they get there, they cannot say, they cannot find the Father. They fail to find the Father. They're taken back off. It's the greatest disappointment they'll ever face.
You're done? That doesn't make any sense to me.
No, just listen through. You got to listen to the rest of the story. Don't just skip the rest of the story.
But it doesn't apply to us because we have Father, Son,
and Spirit. It won't happen for you. Okay? But being from another super universe can potentially fail. Okay? You know, they're given the full opportunity. They can't find the Father, say, for instance. You know, they're taken back out to Avona. They spend a bunch of time trying to get themselves collected and get their gumption up again because they got to be taken back out to their super universe, work a little bit more, and then, you know, they don't have to go through Avona. They come right back to the circuit they failed on, like it was the third circuit, if they're trying to find the Father. Yeah, and then they go again. This time they succeed, you know, and then they finish up the Havona stuff. They do the second circuit and the first circuit, and then, yeah, eventually they're finaliter. Okay, let's do the second paragraph here.
The seven master spirits have their personal seats of power and authority on the seven spheres of the spirit, which circle about paradise in the space between the shining orbs of the sun and the inner circuit of the Havona worlds. But they maintain force focal headquarters on the paradise periphery. Here the slowly circulating presences of the seven supreme power directors indicate the location of the seven flash stations for certain paradise energies going forth to the seven super universes.
Okay, now, that all sounds very straightforward geometrically, you know. You're picturing the seven super universes, okay, going counterclockwise, okay, around the super universe circuit. Okay, it's like, oh, so in the aisles in the center, and you got these little, you know, lighthouses on the periphery, you know, shining out and following them around as they go around. Well, of course, but that's illogical. Because if I, quote-unquote, shine a flashlight out from paradise, it shines in every direction in the super universe, starting at every point in the super universe and shining in every direction. Yeah, because it's totally outside of space, okay? So are they stretching the, yes, see. You can't take that simplistically. It isn't like seven searchlights, you know.
What are you if you're not in space? I don't understand that concept.
If you understood that concept, you would be worshiping the Father on paradise right now. Okay? That's the whole point. It's like, well, I don't want to believe in a God I can't understand. Well, you know, I mean, again, then you have to worship the guy in the burning bush. I mean, because that, I mean, that's what we're stuck. You know, we have to let go of a God we can understand, or the place where he lives being understandable. That's the whole point. It literally is beyond anything that we can understand. But you can at least begin to appreciate that it's not anything that you could even extrapolate what you know to understand it. Okay? So it's like, well, if I'm not supposed to understand that paragraph literally, as seven big energy beams going around like searchlights shining out to the little segment in the super universe level, what am I supposed to get from that? What they're saying is there is a relationship. I mean, it's not a simple geometric thing where you can draw radial lines through Havona out into the super universe level. But they're saying that even though it isn't literally factual, there's a truth connection in some way that we can't comprehend. There's a translation of the relationship of a given supreme power director to the aisle. The supreme power director is anchoring himself at a different point on the aisle, and because he does that, in some way we can't comprehend his energy activity engages his super universe, synchronized with the motion of the super universe around his level. Okay? There has to be some kind of motion, you know, quote unquote, going on to synchronize with a motion out here. There can't be no motion synchronizing with motion. Only motion can synchronize with motion. That's the point they're trying to get. They're painting a simple picture so you can just immediately visualize it. But if you're not satisfied with a simple finite shadow picture, you know, you go, oh, so they're trying to give me the philosophical connection. Okay? All right.
Here on peripheral paradise are the enormous historic and prophetic exhibit areas assigned to the Creator Sons, dedicated to the local universes of time and space. There are just 7 trillion of these historic reservations now set up or in reserve, but these arrangements altogether occupy only about 4% of that portion of the peripheral area thus assigned. We infer that these vast reserves belong to creations, sometime to be situated beyond the borders of the present known and inhabited 7 super universes.
Okay, this is a very important paragraph for those who like to understand the little details. You know, lots of places in the book, they point to this whole hierarchy of systems and constellations and all this, you know, and giving you a total of the number of worlds in the 7 super universes. And it always says, okay, roughly, approximately 7 trillion. Because, I mean, all the numbers are exact, except it's only, you know, approximately 1,000 inhabited worlds per local system. It's not exactly 1,000, you know, even when it's all settled. Okay? Notice this. What did it say? There are precisely 7 trillion. So So just think about it a minute. A light bulb should go off about why there isn't exactly 7 trillion inhabited worlds when all is said and done. What are you doing when you take an inhabited world, you know, deep into the seventh stage of light and life, and you're getting the whole grand universe settled, light and life, and all that sort of stuff? Every inhabited world is like an architectural sphere at that point. There isn't any difference between architectural spheres and the inhabited worlds. In other words, the total number of architectural spheres and inhabited worlds is exactly 7 trillion. That's why the number of regular inhabited worlds is a little less. Okay? And there's about, just roughly, there's about 450 billion, say, the architectural spheres in the 7 super universes. Mm-hmm. It rounds up to 7 trillion inhabited worlds, because it's a little less than 500 billion, see? So, yeah, the other side rounds up to 7 trillion. Okay. But this is a very key spot. How does paradise see the superuniverse? Does it see it as, well, it's not very done yet? No, it sees it from an eternal viewpoint, where there is no difference between inhabited worlds and architectural spheres and eternity. I mean, Lord knows what it sees when it looks at, this should really boggle the mind. I mean, it's like, well, does it even see Jupiter? Well, it's like, it's got to see Jupiter somehow because it has gravity. And it's like, okay, this is really confusing, see? I mean, but in some way, it has a relationship to the architectural spheres and inhabited worlds as if there's no distinction. It sees them as a settled thing where they're one and the same thing. And who knows what geometry they're in and whatnot. But, yeah, but that's a key little point there. Skip right through it, unless you're noticing the words, and it's the one spot in the book where they give you that, that clue, to get you to just think a little bit more, and it's once you just think about it a little bit, and you're like, oh yeah, and there's those spots in the book where they say, okay, there's roughly, 7 trillion inhabited worlds, then there's the architectural spheres. they often will juxtapose those two things. It's like, okay, put them together in a puddle. How many do you think there are all together? All right.
That portion of paradise which has been designated for the use of the existing universes is occupied only from 1 to 4%, while the area assigned to these activities is at least 1 million times that actually required for such purposes. Paradise is large enough to accommodate the activities of an almost infinite creation.
Okay, so, you just get the point. I mean, even, you take some little minor issue like this, and always it's just, way more.
Lavish.
Yeah, it's just completely lavish in space everywhere you look. It's like, well, I could take this little circumscribed thing. That must be just what you need. No, it's way more than you need. So it's just basically infinite space there in terms of, in practical terms.
But a further attempt to visualize to you the glories of paradise would be futile. You must wait and ascend while you wait, for truly, eye has not seen nor ear heard, neither has it entered into the mind of mortal man, the things which the universal Father has prepared for those who survive the life in the flesh on the worlds of time and space.
That's pretty fun there. He throws in, a Bible quote. And here it's helpful to have a little bit of biblical knowledge about that quote. This is step 3 in the evolution of that quote. The original quote is in Isaiah. And then in 1 Corinthians, Paul quotes, quote unquote, quotes Isaiah, but tweaks it a little bit, expands on it a little bit. So what do the revelers do? The revelers take what Paul said, and they expand it a little bit more. So that you actually have this three-step evolution of taking that quote from very primitive times, you know, during the exile, you know, or, you know, around that time, you know, all the way up into something that's fully fleshed out and speaks to the truth of the aisle. That you know, and is it fitting? You know, now step back and how did we begin the evening with allusions to the most holy place and the holy place and the holy land and the temple? And we end, you know, with Isaiah. Upstepped. Okay. Because we started with the temple and the holy land. Upstepped. The whole thing, it's a nice little bookends, these two sections. For these two sections. You know, they've just taken all of these ancient notions and they've just lifted them up. This is a great example of what, when we say that the book is an evolutional construct, it's not an evolutionary, it didn't evolve into existence, okay, it was written, okay, but it's evolutional. It's taking what we have and morphing it in masterful fashion. You know, something as simplistic as you know, notion of, you know, Ark of the Covenant and the Holy of Holies and all this sort of stuff and incense and sacrifices and all that, whatnot. You know, it's like, no, you know, there's some things we can work with there. Let's build that up. Let's show them the truth of those ancient thoughts.
Okay. You can't just call it simply expanding on truth.
Well, that's what they're doing. They're showing you the truth. They're showing you that those things aren't just primitive notions that you should throw out. There's little threads of truth. I mean, another way of looking at it is, were all of those humans back then the embodiment of deceit and emptiness? No, of course not. There were many very sincere individuals. I mean, Elijah fused, for Pete's sake. Okay. Okay. There were many very sincere individuals. They were trying their best with what little they had to understand God and their relationship to God. And the fact that this book can be constructed evolutionally speaks to that. There's a thread of truth in even the most primitive efforts to understand your nature and your relationship to God and to honor that, to worship that, that you can take that, you can reach in and grab the thread of truth and expand it. You know, bring it out into the light. Bring it out of what's it's imprisoned in, the simplistic primitive notions that it's imprisoned in. You know, the most holy sphere and the holy area can't be achieved through masonry on hilltops. But that which you quest and, you know, and had the zeal to build in, you know, grand form, lots of gold and whatnot and massive ceilings and all this. I mean, you had so much zeal because you felt that the power of that thought so deeply that you moved mountains to try to make it manifest so that you could engage it. I mean, you need to ask yourself, why do you feel that need? You know, why did Orange Man feel the uncontrollable urge to pile rocks up into big piles? Okay? Because he wanted to transcend the plane. He would dedicate his whole life to that effort, okay? Duty, religious duty, you know, drives man, okay? And we've in modern times, we've become so skeptical. You know, we think, well, you know, this is primitive people with dumb notions. No, they're sincere religionists, and they're trying their best with what little they have. But that's your problem. Forget about all that. Deep down in the core, it's true, and it's dutiful, and God loves it. Okay? You know, and we don't want to throw that out. Don't throw that baby out with the bathwater of a bunch of foolishness with, you know, this sacrifice and that sacrifice and what direction to point and what knife to use and whatnot. Okay? Don't throw out the religious duty and the humble sincerity. You know, if you want to be a religionist predicated on the solider picture of the universe that we have here in our laps, you have to start with a nucleus of duty. You can't be a second miler if you aren't a first miler first. You can't navigate yet by volition, like on paradise. No matter how much you want to, you can't go from point A to point C, skipping point B. You have to go through point B. Okay? To get to be a second miler, you have to be a first miler first. You can't skip being a first miler. You can't skip duty. I'd like to get to worship, third cosmic intuition level. Well, you can't get there by skipping the second cosmic intuition level. First just, then, okay. Remember, you got to go up the levels, okay? Causation, then duty, then worship. If you want to truly worship, you must first be dutiful. To be a second miler on the sixth level, you need to be a first miler on the second level. They're first. Fifth level, I mean, they're first. You know, the second cosmic intuition has to precede, you know, a genuine engagement of the third cosmic intuition. And notice how it all has a foundation. That's the thing that we're trying to add that the ancients didn't have. They didn't have the solid foundation of the first cosmic intuition to build this duty and worship upon, so that it wasn't so artificial and groping, grasping. Okay? That's what the revelation allows us to now build a solid foundation. We can have a causal, logical relationship, say, with the notion of where God is and the magnitude of God and our place in the big picture. We can get that clear and logical in our head. No wishful, fanciful notions clouding our foundation. Our foundation could be clear and solid like the aisle. Okay? And then now we can build true duty instead of what so often ended up being kind of false duty. We can build true duty. And then and only then we can build the true worship that we so desire if we are sincerely a religionist and not just a spiritualist. Yeah, or even a spiritist, you know, a mystic. Okay, that's what it builds up to. That's what we're looking for. We're looking for this grounded and sincere relationship. How dutiful are you going to need to be to make this journey? To be able to, like we're saying, to finally be that person that can stand. And, you know, this is reserved for the functions of worship, trinitization, and high spiritual attainment. That worship you crave can only be done in that place that vaporizes everything that you can think of right now. You have such a long journey. It has to be humble and duteous ahead of us to get there. And there's no way to do it if you try to build that duty on sand. The fifth epical revelation is here to finally give us the solid foundation upon which to have the kind of duty that can stand the test of the ages that it's going to take. in some super universes, it has to even withstand failure on the aisle. Having to go back, do some more, and come back again. You have to have that solid a duty, relationship to duty, you know, a duty that loves its duty. Yeah. Okay. So, the reason I wanted to kind of give that little bit of solid food for your spirit is because next time it's Nether Paradise, followed by Space Respiration, followed by Space Functions on Paradise, followed by Paradise Gravity, okay, kind of physics sort of stuff, okay? So, in other words, he's basically said what he can say about the spirit stuff. And then you're reminded, oh, we are talking about the Isle of Paradise after all. Okay? We're not in paper one. We're talking about the absolute of matter. The most of the story is going to be about absolutum and its relationship to physics. Okay? All right. Well, let's take a little moment here.